This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا لئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste the favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good, they shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories: U.S. Attorney General William Barr authorizes a probe into allegations of voting irregularities as President Donald Trump claimed he lost the presidential election due to fraud. Scuffles erupt in Peru where supporters of President Vizcarra take to the streets to protest against the impeachment and Congress. Asian markets rise for a second day on hopes for progress on a possible vaccine for COVID-19 that has battered the world economy. Welcome to the program. U.S. President Donald Trump's campaign has unveiled a new lawsuit against election officials in the state of Pennsylvania. The campaign has alleged that the state's mail-in voting system lacked the transparency and verifiability that in-person voting had. The lawsuit seeks to stop Pennsylvania officials from certifying President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the state. Trump's campaign has so far brought several such lawsuits in Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, and Michigan under similar accusations. Attorney General William Barr has authorized federal prosecutors to carry out probes into allegations of voting and tabulation irregularities. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said the president has a legal right to look into the issue.
And the courts are here to work through concerns. Our institutions are actually built for this. We have the system in place to consider concerns, and President Trump is 100% within his rights to look into allegations of irregularities and weigh his legal options.
In the meantime, an official from Biden's transitional team stressed that the General Services Administration must recognize the election results so a power transition can begin. The official added that the transitional team can pursue legal action if the government agency refuses to affirm Biden's victory. Biden cannot access government funds or communicate with federal agencies until the GSA certifies his win. This is several Republican senators, as well as a stream of world leaders, have already congratulated Biden on his election win. Colin Campbell in Washington, D.C. says the lawsuit brought by President Trump's campaign against U.S. election officials is likely to be thrown out due to a lack of evidence.
A lot of these cases that he's filed so far, he hasn't had a very good track record with them. They've been thrown out because he doesn't have the evidence. A lot of these admissions or allegations are self-anecdotal. They are the narratives of other people just trying to say that they've seen something when they may not have. And I think what judges are looking for is tangible evidence, concrete evidence, that there's massive voter fraud here. What's in addition to this, even if there are cases of voter fraud, unless it's on a widespread, massive scale, the amount of votes that the former vice president has, the president's rival, Joe Biden, has, in comparison to what he has, it really wouldn't change the outcome. It would maybe be a few votes here and there, even if it's 1,000 here and 1,000 there, it's not going to overturn the multiple thousands or tens of thousands that Biden has outdistanced the president collectively.
The United Nations has criticized the United States over a host of issues related to its human rights record. In a session dubbed Universal Periodic Review, the UN Human Rights Council raised the issues of police brutality, racial discrimination, and mistreatment of migrants in the U.S. under the administration of President Donald Trump. Several member states also called on the U.S. to reverse a decision to withdraw the UN rights body and to end sanctions on members of the International Criminal Court. The council expressed hope that the next U.S. administration would work to roll back what it called Trump's harmful policies. All U.N. members undergo the review every 4 to 5 years. Monday marked Washington's third review since 2015. Political activist Life Malcolm says the United States disregards international laws as well as the U.N. recommendations on human rights.
In 2011, the United States, the UPR, had a review of the United States for similar things. They called it then systemic racism, and they mentioned the brutal tactics that the United States impose on African people here through their police force all the time. But the United States consistently disregards these recommendations by the United Nations and the UPR. So while it's good that the United Nations UPR makes these recommendations, what's clear is the United States is a dictatorship that rules without regard for law. I mean, it's interesting, this go around, they call the United Nations and the UPR attempts to attribute what's occurring here now to the Trump administration. But as I just mentioned, in 2001, Donald John Trump wasn't the president, it was George W. Bush in 2009, and in 2015, in 2011, I think I mentioned that year too, it was Barack Hussein Obama who was the president. And now this thing is happening with Trump. So it's not whoever's in the White House, it's the United States itself.
Scuffles have erupted in Peru's capital, Lima, where supporters of President Martin Vizcarra rallied to protest against his impeachment at Congress. Police in riot gear tried to push back angry protesters gathering at the iconic site of the Plaza San Martin. The protesters shouted slogans to denounce the impeachment trial. Peruvian lawmakers voted overwhelmingly to remove the popular president over corruption allegations. Vizcarra said he will accept the motion, but he categorically rejected accusations of taking bribes from companies that won public works contracts. The head of Congress is expected to assume power on Tuesday. Manuel Merino will remain in office until the end of the current term, which is in July of 2021. The presidential election, mind you, will be held next year in April. The news of the economy markets in Asia have rallied following news of progress in the development of a vaccine for COVID-19 that has battered the world economy. Tokyo, Hong Kong, Sydney, and Jakarta all rose more than 1% on Tuesday. Singapore and Manila surged over 3%. There were also modest gains in Seoul, Shanghai, and Wellington. The strong performance was led by companies including airlines, which have been hammered for most of the year by virus lockdowns. The gains in Asian markets followed the positive lead overnight from the U.S. and Europe. Hopes for an end to the pandemic has risen after a U.S. pharmaceutical giant and its German partner said Monday their vaccine was more than 90% effective in preventing infection. Political commentator Mr. Andrew Leong earlier told me there is no guarantee that markets will continue to rise in the coming weeks following their latest gains in the wake of good news on the COVID vaccine.
For the market has been in the doldrums for too long, and everybody's waiting for some sort of good news. Let's not forget that this vaccine, even though it's a kind of breakthrough, is still 90%, not 100% ineffective. So it remains to be seen whether it's going to pass all the hurdles. And secondly, even if it has passed all the hurdles, it's a question of how many people are going to receive the vaccine, bearing in mind, first of all, to what extent the supply will be able to meet the global demand. And secondly, I think that the chances are that the vaccine will be geared towards protecting all the paramedics, you know, the nurses, the frontline medical staff. But nevertheless, it is a welcome news. And obviously, as I said, that the market has been waiting for something like this for a long time. But let's beware of too much euphoria. And then let's not, the market is only registered, you know, 1 or 2% maximum at the moment. So it's a kind of cautious optimism. But apart from the vaccine, there's also the question of the seeming to be the end of the U.S. presidential election, ending some of the uncertainty.
Armenia's Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan says he has reached an agreement with Russia and Azerbaijan to end fighting over the dispute in Nagorno-Karabakh region. Pashinyan says he took the decision after a deep analysis of the military situation. However, he said the move had been, quote, unbelievably painful. The announcement sparked outrage in the Armenian capital, Yerevan. There, thousands gathered outside the government headquarters to call for Pashinyan's resignation. Groups of protesters also stormed the government headquarters and the parliament building. The ceasefire is being overlooked by some 2,000 Russian peacekeepers. The Azerbaijani president says Turkey will also be involved in implementing the truce. Three previous ceasefires failed to end the fighting between Azerbaijan and Armenia over Nagorno-Karabakh. Political commentator Pablo González says the agreement to end the war on the Nagorno-Karabakh region amounts to a military victory for Azerbaijan.
This ceasefire seems clearly like the end of the war with the victory of Azerbaijan with the support of Turkey. This ceasefire, if they what we know as the main points of this agreement is what Baku wanted. So they recovered big areas of the Karabakh region. It was their main goal. And now they allow the peacekeepers to be in the region. So for them, it's the perfect situation. Also, they will have now access since the by land to the Nakhichevan region. So it's something that they will never expect before. So they have one of the part, they have all the things that they wanted, and the other part, the part that lost, that is Armenia Artsakh, they need to sign that to don't lose more.
Thousands of Georgians have hit the streets of the capital, Tbilisi, for a second day now to back opposition calls for a rerun of last month's parliamentary elections. Police detained some protesters. The opposition and protesters who defied a COVID-19 curfew claimed the election was rigged. Police used water cannons outside the Central Election Commission where the protesters had gathered. There were also reports of police firing tear gas at them. Police denied that report, though. During the protests on Sunday, dozens of people were also injured. Another UN agency for Palestinian refugees says it lacks funds to pay the salaries of its employees. The UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East says it needs to raise $70 million by the end of the month to be able to pay full salaries for the months of November and December. The funding shortfall affects 28,000 staffers in the occupied West Bank and Gaza, among other places in the region. The agency's spokeswoman said UNRWA never recovered from the total funding cut imposed by Donald Trump's administration in 2018. Tamara Al-Rafai expressed optimism that the U.S. President-elect Joe Biden's administration will restore Washington's annual $300 million aid. UNRWA runs schools and provides health services as well as other humanitarian aid to an estimated 5.7 million Palestinian refugees. Coronavirus infections in the Gaza Strip are on the rise amid a fragile health system in the impoverished enclave. Gaza lacks enough resources to fight the pandemic due to the Israeli blockade. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon brings us more.
Coronavirus cases among the general population are rapidly increasing in the Gaza Strip as over 200 infections are being discovered daily. The first community spread of the deadly virus was detected in late August, and over 8,000 cases have been discovered so far. Health officials have sounded the alarm over the rising figures in the densely populated enclave.
The number of infections in the Gaza Strip is high, and we are extremely worried due to the rising number. We are doing our best to deal with the situation. We are working around the clock to detect infections.
The coronavirus has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip. COVID-19 has threatened the socioeconomic welfare of nearly 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza as much as their health.
People here don't have access to preventive equipment because they're crash strapped. They can hardly provide food for their families.
People have been suffering from the Israeli blockade, and now the situation has only gotten worse because of the coronavirus pandemic.
The Israeli blockade in place since 2007 has had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver. Gaza's health sector is suffering from acute shortage in medicines and hospital supplies.
14 years of the inhumane Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip have taken their toll on the humanitarian, health and economic situation. The Israeli blockade has left the health system in Gaza in ruin, making it unable to deal with the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus is fast spreading in the Gaza Strip, and people fear the worst because of the high population density.
As infections continue to rise, rights groups are calling for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade to help fight the spread of the deadly coronavirus. Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
And finally, Everlasting Days is the title of a new TV series produced in Iran that deals with the U.S. espionage mission in Iran during the days of the 1979 Islamic Revolution and afterwards. Youssef Jalali has more.
From the days of the 1979 Islamic Revolution to the onset of the longest war of the 20th century between Iraq and Iran, Everlasting Days tracks the footprints of U.S. intelligence services and their conspiracies in Iran based on true events. Produced by Mohsen Ali Akbari and directed by Javad Shemagdari, the TV show will have two sequels. The first season, which is ready for airtime, reviews the chain of events that led to the victory of the Islamic Revolution against the backdrop of the West's attempts to save the former Pahlavi regime from a total collapse.
The first season narrates nine eventful and historic months of the Islamic Revolution that led to the victory of the revolution. The series will reveal how the CIA tirelessly sought to derail the fledgling Islamic Revolution during its early days. The story is entirely based on true events and took us 3 years to compile the needed information, part of which was taken from the documents that were left by the American diplomats in the former U.S. embassy.
The 1979 marked the beginning of the collapse of Iran-U.S. ties. A group of Iranian students who climbed the main gate of the U.S. embassy and then take the staff members as hostages. The incident was also shown in American films such as Argo. However, Iranian filmmakers say the American movie did not remotely reflect the reality about the hostage-taking issue, as it did not show the whole picture. They say Everlasting Days tries to piece together all sides of the puzzle to offer a documented answer to this question, Why do Iranians call the former U.S. embassy the den of espionage?
If it wasn't for the students' spontaneous action, the Islamic Revolution would have collapsed within less than a year. What the students did was to wisely reveal the U.S.'s dirty job at an embassy that did not look anything like an embassy, but an espionage organization. In the film, you will see American officials becoming disappointed with their anti-Iranian plots after the students' takeover of the embassy totally disconnected the U.S. officials from their intelligence network in Iran.
God damn it, Bill.
The production team is now working on the script of the second season, which will deal with the aftermath of the U.S. embassy takeover, all the way to the U.S.'s role in triggering the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran just a year later. The first season will go on air in less than 2 months.
The production crew here says with the release of the TV series, the audience, especially those from the younger generations, will find the answers to some of the key questions about how the Islamic Revolution and the ensuing socio-political events will shape the course of history in their country. Questions that once answered will lead the viewers to take more pride in their country and their identity as Iranians. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And that's it with international news.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. and leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
In the limelight.
Presidents presiding over recessions usually lose in a landslide, so why didn't Donald Trump? It is something of an axiom in American presidential election years that if the economy is in poor shape, the incumbent party will lose. And indeed, as Americans cast their votes on Tuesday, 3rd of November, the United States was facing a recession largely due to President Donald Trump's bungling pandemic response. While what little economic recovery had occurred since its dawn primarily benefited the upper class. Joe Biden, of course, won the election, but it wasn't a landslide win. The fact that the race was so close belies this old political adage. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Matthew Rosa and has been taken from the website Salon.com. The piece is titled, Presidents Presiding Over Recessions Usually Lose in a Landslide. Why Didn't Trump? Stay with us for more of Matthew Rosa's article. Presidents presiding over recessions usually lose in a landslide, so why didn't Donald Trump? It is something of an axiom in American presidential election years that if the economy is in poor shape, the incumbent party will lose. And indeed, as the American public cast their votes on Tuesday, 3rd of November, the United States was facing a recession largely due to President Donald Trump's bungling pandemic response. Whilst what little economic recovery had occurred since its dawn primarily benefited the upper class. Joe Biden, of course, won the election, but it wasn't a landslide win. The fact that the race was so close belies this old political adage. So what happened? Is the economy no longer the main concern for presidential voters, or was this year a special case? Interestingly, exit polls show Donald Trump still receives significant support from economy-minded voters, meaning many voters still see him as strong on the economy, despite economic data to the contrary. Perhaps the pandemic situation is seen as a special case, or perhaps Joe Biden was not perceived as strong on the economy, or as doing anything to help struggling Americans. Trump is an extreme blabbermouth, according to Dr. Richard Wolff, Professor Emeritus of Economics at University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Dr. Wolff added, "He's offensive, I get all that, but out of his mouth comes what significant groups of our society want to hear, so he can achieve the normal Republican goals, which is an alliance between the servants of big business and enough members of the employee class to get them into power. So they can serve big business, that's the game." Dr. Richard Wolff contrasted this with the Democrats, Big business shells out the bucks that the Republican Party uses it to win the offices that will then give to their constituents. Anti-immigration, white supremacists, gun lovers, abortion haters, and everybody else they can collect. Give them what they want, and then you have the deal, Wolf explained. The Democratic Party is caught in a contradiction that it doesn't want to face. It goes to the same corporations and rich people for money, and they get money. But then, you can't be the champion of the employee class, because what the employee class wants is a direct threat to big business and the rich, and so you're stuck. As a result, Dr. Richard Wolf believes that Joe Biden took moderate positions on many issues, being caught in this contradiction. That, Wolf says, may have cost him voters. As Dr. Wolf noted, one secret to Donald Trump's success is that he's enlivening various members of his base, something that Joe Biden, in contrast, didn't really do. Trump is giving to the evangelicals more of what they want, is giving to the white supremacists more of what they want, more than all the previous Bush-type Republicans ever were. He has strengthened and rallied the collection of people Republicans always had, the gun enthusiasts, the opponents of abortion, all of that. Only he's made them more happy and more enthusiastic because he differentiates himself from the other Republicans precisely by being extreme. According to Richard Wolf, whatever policy Joe Biden gets behind, he does it moderately. He has always done that sort of thing, unless it's something where there is no opposition, like beating up on the Chinese or the socialists or whatever it is that has no political costs. Richard Wolf is not the only economic expert who has argued that ostensibly liberal parties suffer when they fail to support bold measures to help working class voters. In 2018, French political economist Thomas Piketty wrote a paper which explained that parties claiming to be left-wing do not perform as well when their supposed support for the working class clashes with the perception that they are elitist. Whilst the Democratic Party in the United States and its closest counterparts in the United Kingdom and France, that is the Labour Party and the Socialist Party respectively, did well in the 1950s and 60s, when the vote for left-wing, socialist, Labour, Democratic parties was associated with lower education and lower income voters, over time those parties become associated with higher education voters. As a result, Thomas Piketty wrote, these countries developed a system of multiple elite parties where high education elites now vote for the left, whilst high income, high wealth elites still vote for the right, though less and less so. This has led to rising income inequality and the inability of democratic institutions to effectively address it. Just as ominous, it has paved the way for right-wing populists like Donald Trump, Nigel Farage in Britain, and Marine Le Pen in France. Without a strong egalitarian internationalist platform, it is difficult to unite low-education, low-income voters from all origins within the same party, Piketty observed. Other economists who spoke to Salon.com agreed that voters were concerned about the economy, yet somehow they did not blame Donald Trump. The pandemic tanked the economy, but many Trump voters didn't seem to blame the president for that, seeing it more as an act of God, said Dr. Gabriel Mathey, a macroeconomist at American University. Dr. Gabriel Mathey added, the economic recovery since 2009, while slow, has been steady and resulted in one of the hottest economies before the pandemic. Trump's tax cuts that benefited corporations and the very wealthy also boosted the stock market beyond the strong economy. So I don't think that there's much Biden could have done. Voters reward incumbent presidents for strong economic performance, and Donald Trump didn't seem to take much blame for the current recession. He added, presidents are also rewarded for stimulus packages, and Donald Trump was president when the CARES Act was passed, which was insufficient but still one of the most ambitious stimulus packages in U.S. history. Another economist who spoke to Salon.com echoed Dr. Gabriel Mathis's views. Even years from now, sweeping claims about what caused this election's outcome will be largely guesswork, Dr. Carl Weidequist, an American political philosopher and economist at Georgetown University's Qatar campus, wrote to Salon. It is possible that large numbers of people blame COVID-19 precautions rather than the lack of government relief for the cost of COVID-19 precautions. And perhaps Democrats could have done a better job of blaming Republicans for the failure to pass more economic stimulus. Salon.com also asked economic experts about the policies that will best help financially struggling and working class voters. Given immediate needs, having more transfer to households and businesses through additional checks, paycheck protection programs, and expanded unemployment insurance would help alleviate the current situation, Gabriel Mathis suggested. We will see if there is a stimulus package to be passed in the lame duck. McConnell may want to pass the package under Trump and then point to Biden's inability to pass a stimulus package in the 2022 midterms. McConnell also has more leverage now, as the House Democratic majority will be narrow and the Democrats will not take back the U.S. Senate. Dr. Weidequist expressed similar views, writing to Salon that direct individual universal cash grants are the best response to emergency. They are a bonus to those who remain in work and a cushion for those who can't find work or can't work because of the crisis. All people have different needs. With cash, they're free to buy who they know and they know what they need. As people spend their bonuses, the money trickles up to business owners and investors who figure out how to provide people what they need at this time. He added, some proposals on the table include $2,000 per person per month for 4 to 6 months, or perhaps even longer if the crisis lasted longer. That would have been a great idea when the lockdown started, and it's still a good idea now. Dr. Richard Wolff told Salon that Americans need a modern-day equivalent of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal, perhaps something akin to the Green New Deal proposed by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. He specifically said that Americans need to improve their social security system so that those who live on it will not be poor, raising the minimum wage so that people can live off of it, including tying it to inflation, increasing unemployment insurance, and a federal jobs program. What in the world is going on that this is not part of our national discussion? How in the world does Joe Biden look himself in the face in the morning? After describing the success of Roosevelt's New Deal program, which created millions of jobs in response to the Great Depression of the 1930s, Dr. Wolff explained that we now have, depending on your estimates, 20 to 25% of the Americans unemployed. They shouldn't be. They should be hired by the government tomorrow. The actual amount of money you have to pay them, if you paid them, isn't that much more than the state on unemployment and the federal supplement that are now in place. Only the difference would be a significant gain for them, some increase in the money they take home, and there's an enormous benefit to society in terms of all the work they can do.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bulletin.
Leaders from around the world have congratulated former Vice President Joe Biden on winning the U.S. presidential election, despite allegations of electoral fraud from sitting President Donald Trump, who has so far refused to concede. World leaders are already preparing for a new approach with hopes the U.S. will rejoin the World Health Organization in the Paris Climate Accords. In the U.K., talks of a U.S. trade deal have come with caveats of the Good Friday peace agreement, which weakens the U.K.'s negotiating stance when it comes to Brexit, something Downing Street was not too concerned about with Trump. In Iran, the government remains cautious, even though Biden has made rejoining the Iran nuclear deal one of his priorities. Iran has maintained that international law is the bedrock of negotiations and unlawful sanctions must be removed before any further dialogue. Well, let's talk to political commentator Mohsen Abbas about that story. Good to see you again, Mohsen. So Trump says it's not over yet. World leaders are congratulating Biden. What's the state of play here?
Well, of course, it is a bit premature, although this is the normal customary reaction. Whenever an election is declared in the way it has been, world leaders usually do congratulate the new president or the incumbent. However, in this instance, of course, there's never been such a kind of heavy, if you like, dose of allegation. And at the moment, that's all they are, because Donald Trump hasn't presented any evidence of a fixing of the elections, but there's certainly a large stir. However, you know, it's really quite premature in the sense that the official electoral college, which is yet to meet and cast their votes, hasn't really declared Biden the president. Many are arguing the electoral college can't decide anything until lawsuits and court proceedings take place, others are saying. Of course, court proceedings will definitely happen. They're going to happen in Michigan, they're going to happen in Wisconsin and Georgia and Pennsylvania. They may happen in Arizona as well and Nevada. But the Supreme Court is interesting on this because the appointment of Amy Coney Barrett, who was actually appointed by Trump, is obviously something which Trump can look to, and the Supreme Court is looking at Pennsylvania already. All of this, of course, augurs badly for American democracy, and the possibility of conflict, continued conflict, is definitely there.
All right, we'll have to wait and see. But the reason world leaders have rushed to congratulate Biden, do you think it's because there is a sense that the majority of nations wanted to, for Biden to win, to sort of restore a sense of normality? And do you think a change of administration would mean a change of policy in any meaningful way?
Well, absolutely. They wanted, I think, Biden to win. Certainly his allies across NATO and various others would probably prefer him to win, although the Saudi Arabians haven't declared their acknowledgement of the new presidency. Other than that, his usual allies have. And that is because, you know, he tore up the Paris Agreement, as you mentioned. He tore up the Trans-Pacific treaties. He was destabilizing on so many levels international agreements that, mm-hmm. of course, they want him to rejoin the pack. Of course, JCPOA was the biggest problem of all, which brings in...
Let me put this final question to you before we run out of time. Biden has said he'd re-sign the U.S. into international institutions and agreements, and I want to talk about specifically the Iran nuclear deal. Is Iran to take Biden for his words, briefly?
Iran certainly won't. I don't think their policy is going to change unless, of course, we get a situation where the Americans drop economic sanctions, accept JCPOA as was agreed, arguably, but even that is in question. I think the Iranians are right not to trust Biden because Biden is a nasty imperialist aggressor himself. You know, he's a Zionist, he's a declared Zionist, so is Kamala Harris. You can't expect any change in their support for Israel and their injustice across West mm-hmm. Asia. So why should Iran trust Biden any more than Trump?
All right. We're going to have to leave it there. Mohsen Abbas, political commentator. Thank you, as always. We're going to stick with the U.S. elections as concerns over a transition process linger. The U.S. Vice President or President-elect has already gotten down to work. Joining me now, Richard Sudan, to tell us what Joe Biden has been up to. Richard, good to see you.
So, of course, Saeed, the world is continuing to react to the news that Joe Biden is now the president-elect and he'll be the next president of the United States. And, of course, Joe Biden has delivered a speech which everyone is talking about over the last couple of days. The speech was very interesting. Of course, it was full of the kind of usual platitudes you might expect, especially in the wake of a divided country. And there were several nods to Obama within the speech from Joe Biden and also Kamala Harris. But I thought what was interesting in the speech is that Joe Biden said Black America had had his back and he is going to have theirs. Now, this is extremely significant. Now, of course, it sounds good on the face of it, but a lot of critics have basically said, look, Joe Biden has not got a good track record regarding Black America. Of course, he was one of the architects of the 94 crime bill, which saw thousands of black people incarcerated. And of course, you know, the fact is Kamala Harris has been on record actually saying that she's not going to do anything specific for black Americans. And I think the reality is that black Americans are dealing with grave injustices in the U.S. They have been for many, many years, and that continues. So I think there's
You think now that they've got the vote and they've won the presidency, they're going to go on and forget all about black Americans?
Well, I think this is the kind of cynical take that a lot of people, frankly, are having. And I think now the task really for many people is that they're going to have to hold Joe Biden's political feet to the fire, so to speak, to make sure he makes good on his promises to black America. Of course, over the summer, we've seen massive Black Lives Matter protests throughout the country in the wake of the George Floyd killing. But of course, black injustice, killings at the hands of the state and also militia groups, some would say often working with the state, have been carrying on for many, many decades. And it seems a stretch to imagine that's going to change anytime soon.
Just talk about the militia group soon. Bring us the online reaction to this story.
So let's go first to a tweet from filmmaker and activist Tariq Nasheed, who says, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were saved by the black vote. they and the Democrats need to be reminded of this every day as they try to use benign neglect tactics against the very black voters who save them while they prioritize other groups. A very strong reaction there. And we have a tweet here from journalist Abby Martin who says, great that Trump is out, but 7 million more people voted for him than in 2016, and COVID is the only reason he barely lost. Biden and surrogates now calling for unity and bipartisanship is a clear signal he'll govern for the GOP centrists and not progressives. Let's get back to fighting the system that bred Trump. Of course, nationalism has been and is on the rise in the United States, and so too is Trumpism, and that's not going to dissipate anytime soon.
Nationalism and Trumpism. Let's move on to your second story. We're going to stay in the United States and threats of violence by some of Donald Trump's far-right militant supporters. What
about that story? It has been and remains extremely dangerous in the U.S. if you're a black American. And now we see that the alleged Proud Boys leader has declared the standby order has been rescinded, of course, in the wake of the Trump loss. Of course, Trump infamously said, stand by, stand down. And now those very groups that took that as a signal are now saying in the wake of Trump's loss, the time to arguably do what they do is now. And this is extremely worrying. These groups are terrorist groups. People characterize them as that. And they are intent on malicious violence and attacking black people, etc. So everyone's discussing this right now. I want to bring up first, if I can, a reaction on this very point. Let's go to a tweet from an online activist known as Great Black Shark, who says, B1 fam, listen up. Parler is a right-wing white supremacist site where extremists congregate. I monitor them constantly. This is a message between the chairman of the Proud Boys and other members. Stay ready to neutralize any threat. They will be looking for soft targets. And I think we can see an image of the internal conversation on Parler between these Proud Boy individuals who are basically saying now is the time, stand by no more and roll out. This is extremely dangerous, and people think this should be viewed as a very serious terrorist threat, specifically targeting black Americans. We have another reaction here from What's the Video, who says, my friend in Washington State said the Proud Boys are posting, stand by, no more, roll out. This is crazy. A reminder that this is a nationwide phenomenon, a nationwide problem. And I think if the new president-elect wants to be taken seriously, he needs to take some serious measures to bring about a system of justice for black Americans where there's been an ongoing system of injustice for many, many years.
All right, Richard Sudan. Richard, thank you as always. All right, time now to look at some other stories this hour. Celebrations in Azerbaijan's capital, Baku, after the country's president, Ilham Aliyev, announced that his country's forces had taken Shusha, the second largest city in the Nagorno-Karabakh enclave. Armenia, however, has denied the town's loss and says fighting is ongoing. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has congratulated the Azeris, saying he believes the remaining lands will be captured too. More than 1,000 people have died in nearly 6 weeks of fighting in and around Nagorno-Karabakh, a mountainous enclave internationally recognized as part of Azerbaijan, but populated and controlled by ethnic Armenians. Thousands have rallied in the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, to protest against the results of last week's parliamentary election, accusing the governing body of rigging the polls. The country's Central Election Commission said the ruling Georgian Dream Party won more than 48% of the ballots, with the largest opposition party, United National Movement, UNM, 27%. Eight opposition parties, including UNM, have said they'd boycott the parliament. Protesters rallying outside the Central Election Commission demanded the government hold another vote. So far, the ruling Georgian Dream Party has denied all accusations of fraud. Fears have been raised of the global economic crisis caused by the coronavirus pandemic triggering new security threats, potentially leading to World War III. Perhaps in preparation for such a scenario, Britain's military is asking for the Treasury to enable long-term investments needed to modernize. Meanwhile, the UK is selling billions of pounds worth of arms, regardless of the human rights records of some of its customers, as Bianca Rahimi reports.
The head of the UK Armed Forces has warned if current smaller conflicts escalate out of control, drawing in more countries and weapons, World War III might break out. In a Remembrance Day interview with Sky News, General Sir Nick Carter said the world is currently, quote, a very uncertain and anxious place.
We have to remember history might not repeat itself, but it has a rhythm. And if you look back at the last century, before both world wars, I think it was unarguable that there was escalation that led to the miscalculation, which ultimately led to war at a scale we would hopefully never see again.
General Carter says that the British Army will comprise 90,000 human soldiers and 30,000 robots by the 2030s. And aside from modernizing and amplifying its own military, the UK is still the world's second largest arms exporter. Military arms deals worth an estimated £39 billion were approved between 2008 and 2017, a third of which went to countries with abysmal human rights records.
But we have not seen any evidence of that. If we stop selling them the bombs, if we stop selling them the planes, that will have an impact on Saudi and on what Saudi can do in Yemen, because we are one of the main exporters of arms to Saudi Arabia. And frankly, we can't make bombs fast enough for them.
The UK currently has £11 billion worth of orders. So how does stockpiling and exporting arms factor into the UK's World War III game plan?
The UK government has spent hundreds of billions of pounds, large amounts of which have yet to be properly even accounted for, in response to the coronavirus crisis. And General Carter knows full well, I suspect, as do many others in government, that at some point a reckoning for this is going to come, and this money is going to have to be found somewhere, either through tax rises or more likely through departmental budget cuts. And so I think possibly what's a motive here, perhaps more likely than the real worry about regional conflicts becoming a world war, is that actually it's a timely opportunity for General Carter, as head of the UK Armed Forces, to remind yet again for the message that is constantly being put out by the think tanks and the media that support strong armed forces, that is that the world is a dangerous place.
The world is still reeling from the results of the presidential elections in the US, undisputedly the world's military heavyweight. And although Donald Trump's four-year term was the first without a new war since Eisenhower, his administration has allowed military voices to shout down those of experienced civil servants in the development of foreign policy. Funding cuts to non-defense federal agencies and many career civil servants resigning means policy planning is being entrusted invariably to those in uniform. Bianca Rahimi, London.
A coronavirus vaccine developed by Pfizer and Germany's BioNTech has been found to be more than 90% effective in immunizing people against the virus. Tested on 43,500 people across six countries, the vaccine has posed zero safety concerns so far. The companies say enough safety data will be required by the third week of November to then take the vaccine to regulators. There are currently dozens of COVID-19 vaccines, all of them in stage three trials, but this joint American-German venture is the first to show such hopeful results. Another U-turn by the British government, this time yielding to a campaign led by Manchester United and England striker Marcus Rashford to extend school meals to disadvantaged kids during the Christmas holiday period. Prime Minister Boris Johnson initially ruled out the support for the most needy, but gave in after cafes and restaurants pledged to do the government's job for it. Over the weekend, Johnson called the young footballer to explain his about-face.
It's obviously most important for the families, and you know, on the phone he kept thanking me, but then in the back of my mind I'm like, it's the families that that deserve the U-turn, and I actually thanked him on behalf of the families, because I know 100% they would have wanted to say thank you to him if they had the chance.
Despite being the world's sixth largest economy, the UK is home to millions living in poverty. Austerity measures have cut support over the past 10 years, leaving services at breaking point. And the pandemic has made a difficult situation worse, fueling anger at the government's initial stance. November 11, 2 days from now, Remembrance Day here in the UK. Millions wear a poppy to mark the occasion. Others don't and have disagreements over its use. More now with Robert Carter, a Brit himself. What's the problem with the poppy, Robert?
Well, there's a massive debate that surrounds this logo. Critics of the poppy say that it has become a pro-war establishment symbol used as British propaganda to basically whitewash the UK's crimes abroad. So you have, for example, the fact that the poppy originally came from the end of World War One, but since then, every single war that Britain's been involved in, since then until now, is used and is commemorated and honoured on the same day. So many of those wars Britain was actually the aggressor in, such as the war and invasion and occupation of Iraq and also Afghanistan, just to name a few, but also right-wing racist individuals and politicians in the UK also adopt the poppy as a kind of symbol of British patriotism against the other, against the foreigner, against Islam, all that type of stuff. You also have war criminals or people accused of being war criminals like Tony Blair choosing to wear the red poppy on a year-on-year basis, and he's responsible for massive deaths of both British servicemen and also native innocent Iraqis and Arabs, just to name a few examples. So a very controversial image it has become, and obviously that's expressed online. I can actually play you an example of this debate raging on British TV recently. It's between a white journalist who was criticizing a black anti-racism activist for just tweeting, questioning the poppy and its legacy. Let's play that out now.
Something you, thanks to them, will never ever have to do. It's entirely different. You are now politicising the poppy, which is entirely the wrong thing to do. People wear them out of respect and out of honour to people. And for you to criticise that, to apply terms like wearing a poppy is immoral, absolutely. No, it isn't. No one in this country is forced to wear a poppy. They wear it if they want to, and they wear it for a very specific reason.
Go on, Femi.
You're misusing the term moral. I mean, I said moral absolute as in something that is we are morally supposed to be doing.
Well, we're not morally supposed to wear a poppy, but people choose to wear them.
And Robert Sun would say the ultimate goal of this poppy patriotism or nationalism is to shut down debate around the UK's foreign policy. What have